Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to the IB Green Minds podcast. This week, we have an exciting change in the way of doing things as we have a guest host in the form of Asta Lapetalainen, who'll be taking the reins and asking the questions. Asta is a fellow student on Imperial Business School's Masters in Climate Change Management and Finance. She grew up in Finland and has worked at the State Treasury of Finland and completed her bachelor's in economics and mathematics at the University of Aberdeen before joining the course. Asta, over to you.
Thanks, Alex.
Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Petteri Taalas, who is the Secretary General of World Meteorological Organization, WMO. WMO is UN's voice on weather, climate, and water. It is the co-founder of IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change, and UNFCCC, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Welcome, Petteri.
Thank you.
I thought it would be useful to start by providing some background for our listeners. Could you briefly explain what WMO does and what is the role of it in international climate change negotiations?
So WMO is a UN specialized agency established already in 1873, and our specialties are related to weather. We are very much dealing with the weather services worldwide, and we are also running the global weather observing system and climate observing system, and also greenhouse gas monitoring is one of our duties. Then we are dealing with the climate, as you said, we are the founding father of IPCC and also the host agency of IPCC today. And then we have also plenty of climate-related expertise in-house. And then we are also dealing with water resources. And water is the field where the impacts of climate change are very much felt. We have severe drought problems, for example, in Africa. We have had record-breaking forest fires worldwide, and that's related to drought. And then we have had also severe flooding event, and at the moment, for example, in Australia, they are suffering because of record-breaking flooding. So this flooding, drought, and disasters, they are also part of our businesses. And in the climate scene, we are the expertise organization on monitoring of the world climate, what's happening in the real atmosphere, temperatures, rainfall, glaciers, greenhouse gas concentrations, sea level, warming of the oceans, warming of the atmosphere, melting of the sea ice, and so forth. So we are very much monitoring that, and we are also providing on annual basis reports on the status of real atmosphere, and that's very much used as a basis of the climate negotiations and how well we are proceeding with the implementation of the Paris Agreement, for example. And I'm also a member of the Secretary General Guterres Climate Core Group with three of my colleagues from other agencies, and we are very much giving him advice, and at the moment we are, for example, preparing the COP26 meeting, which is hosted by UK government in November this year.
Definitely a wide range of responsibilities. To then understand how you ended up here, could you tell a little bit about your career path, and did you always know you wanted to work in policy and climate?
So I have been Secretary General of this organization for 5 years now, and my term ends in 2023, and I was elected for my second term 2 years ago, and before that I was leading in Finland the Finnish Meteorological Institute, which is half research institute, about 350 scientists, and half weather service and marine service organization. And before that, I was a scientist, I was a professor, since 86, and I was dealing with global change, Arctic and Antarctic, climate change, ozone, satellite programs to monitor the status of atmosphere, and so forth. And before that, I studied meteorology at Helsinki University, and I had my PhD on ozone and UV from Helsinki University as well. And then I have been chairman of the board of University of Eastern Finland, where also climate change is one of the key topics. And then I have been member of board of directors, member of, for example, Fortum Energy Company, and that company is interested in providing climate-friendly energy solutions, and I was very much advising the company on those matters.
So was the transition from academia to policy natural, or was there some spark or something that motivated you to do the change?
So I'm not a political player, so we are, everything is based on science, and the nice thing with meteorology is that it's very global area of science, and so weather doesn't know any borders, and we have I would say a family community, and of course these societal impacts of weather, climate, and water, they are one of the fancy things of meteorology. So I have been following, for example, my first program was related to acidification problem in the 80s, and that's a problem that we have been able to solve. Then I wrote my PhD in ozone matters, and we have been also able to solve that problem by signing the Montreal Protocol. And now, of course, the big challenge for the mankind is to implement the excellent Paris Agreement and keep the warming in the limits of 1.5 to 2 degrees. But we are not the political player. We are bringing these facts on the table, and these facts, they're quite useful, and they are, of course, a little bit alarming. And I think that the fact that IPCC has produced its reports, and WMO has also reported on the status of climate, that has been driving the policy makers, and it has been also driving the private sector and also finance sector to invest in climate-friendly solutions. And at the moment, the situation is better than ever, but so far we haven't seen a positive change in the real atmosphere.
Yes, fact-based and science-based to push for change. So
exactly.
If you want a little bit more to understand what you do actually at WNO, when I was doing my research, I read you're leading the WMO's governance restructuring, you're managing WMO's 2030 vision, and well, oversee all the operations as well. So definitely a lot on your plate. What are your key responsibilities and what are your goals for the remaining of your term?
Yeah, so we are a coordinating organization of, 93 members. Practically all of the UN members are members of WMO, and they are having their national service institutes, which are providing weather services in UK. It's UK Met Office. And then we have research institutions, academia, and also private sector, which are dealing with our matters. And we have also established global weather observing system consisting of ground-based satellites, balloon, aircraft, vessel measurements, and that's our core business. And at WMO, we have carried out historical reforms. We are now favoring very much Earth system approach. So for example, this climate change is not only an atmospheric problem. It's not only an ocean problem. It's not only an emission problem. But you have to understand the whole system and also the water problem. So we are very much favoring nowadays Earth system approach. And that's what's needed in climate and also weather business, and then we have opened the doors for private sector. We have growing amount of private sector companies who are providing weather observations, and they have also started provision of weather services. For example, big companies like IBM and Google, they are providing such services nowadays. And then we have about half of our members who don't have proper early warning services, especially in Africa, Caribbean, Pacific Islands, some parts of Latin America, and some parts of Asia, and we are transferring know-how from most developed member countries like UK or Finland to the rest, less developed ones, and that's one of our challenges. At the moment, we have major limitations in the global observing systems in Africa and the island states and some parts of Latin America, and we are just creating new financing mechanisms to improve the situation. And then these impacts of climate change and disasters, they are very much felt through water. And water is a critical component of the welfare of many African countries. Their backbone of their economies is often agriculture, and that's a source of income, that's a source of employment, and finally life and death. So we are just creating a UN-wide consortium with some donors to improve the how we deal with the water, and that's also very important part of climate adaptation. And then, of course, our key issue is to report on the status of climate, and that's what we are doing as WMO. But we have also partner organizations like UNEP. Of course, IPCC, which we are hosting, and also we are dealing with the Oceanographic Commission of UNESCO, and also Global Carbon Project. And we are providing United in Science reports for the heads of states who are meeting typically at the United Nations General Assembly in New York in September. And we have done it already two times, and we are just preparing the next report for the forthcoming General Assembly in September. Of course, everything is now virtual, but we have continued provision of those reports, and those results are very important for decision makers to demonstrate that we are not yet on right track to reach the Paris limits.
I can see themes, water, disaster, providing the science, but as we discussed earlier, all very facts-based, and going from there, what we can do, for example, the disaster services, and I'll come back to the water a bit later for a bit more discussion. But also, as you mentioned, that we are to have the amount of action that we need, we are not really there yet. There was the UNFCCC report in February saying that the current measures reduce emissions by 1%. By 2030 compared to 2010, where it needs to be 45% to reach the 1.5-degree goal. And to quote the UN Secretary General Guterres, 2021 is for a break year to confront the global climate emergency. So as you said, you were in this climate core group for Guterres. And so what are you in the climate group doing and WMO doing to ensure that the required action is taken this year?
Yeah, this is a question where we need several players. From our side, we are bringing the facts on the table, and that's what also IPCC does. IPCC is providing this sixth assessment report starting this year and the remaining parts next year. And of course, this 1.5-degree report, for example, which was published 2.5 years ago, was a little bit a game changer. So instead of talking about 2 degrees, nowadays we are very much talking about 1.5. And it's demonstrated that would be the best for the welfare of the mankind and welfare of the biosphere. So, and then we have other players, UN FCCC, they are the ones who are driving the climate negotiations. And at the moment we have 2/3 of the global emissions under either 2050 or 2060 carbon neutrality plan. And so they are the ones who are driving the negotiations. And our common aim is that we would have 90% of the global emissions under such regime that they would aim at becoming carbon neutral by 2050, and which would mean that we could reach the low limit of Paris Agreement. And then we have UNEP, which is following the emission situation, and they are preparing these gap reports. For example, what needs to happen and what's happening in in real terms to the emissions. And then we have UNDP, which is very much organization which supports less developed countries, and they are, for example, interested in financing climate-friendly solutions, both climate mitigation and also climate adaptation. So we are giving guidance to Guterres, and he's very much negotiating with the heads of state on concrete action, and he's been putting pressure on several governments. And of course, we have now fairly ambitious plans in European Union, UK, Japan, South Korea, South Africa, who all aim at becoming carbon neutral by 2050. And China announced that they would like to become carbon neutral by 2060. And of course, USA, the new administration, is going to allocate quite a bit of both financial and intellectual resources for reaching carbon neutrality by 2050. So that's all very good news, and the situation is much better than before, but what finally matters is what's going to happen in the coming decades. So, and we should start acting now, and some of those countries have ambitious plans for the coming 10 years, for example, European Union, UK, Japan, South Korea. But for example, in the plan of China for the coming 5 years, this is not very well reflected yet, which is a little bit bad news. And also in USA, actually positive things have happened in USA, despite of the bad reputation of the previous administration. They have already fulfilled part of their previous, half of their previous Paris pledges, and it's obvious that there's going to be a boost in the climate mitigation because of the new administration. That's the role of Guterres, to put pressure on the governments, and that's what he's very much doing, and we are advising him, and we are giving him some background information for those negotiations.
So WMO is really providing the science that is there, and what are the facts, and then Guterres and the other organizations are doing more the negotiations part.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as you earlier mentioned, that also with this climate core group, you are preparing COP26 for this November. And I'm assuming that then WMO is going to provide the latest scientific information for the meeting. So what are your aims for COP26, and what do you expect to see?
As I said, the situation is at the moment very promising. And only 2/3 of the global emissions are under such regime that they aim at becoming carbon neutral by 2050, or China in 2060. So that's excellent news, and that's 75% of the global economy already. And now we are, and especially Guterres and his cabinet, they are negotiating with individual governments. That's what also UNFCCC is doing. And the situation is quite promising because in the USA, for example, they have been putting their best resources behind these kind of negotiations. And that seems to be the case also in China. They have an excellent chief negotiator from their side. And the basic idea is to encourage also other countries to proceed. And as I said, the key issue is what's going to happen during the coming 10 years or coming 20 years. This is not the question that we can leave to be solved when you are 50 years old or 60 years old. So we have to start acting during the coming years. Everything doesn't happen overnight. We have some time to make the change, but real plans and real action finally matters.
Exactly. Words are not enough. We need concrete action.
And also, what's at COP is they're putting adaptation to more on the front, getting so that there is some of the limelight as well. And as you discussed earlier, WM provides the early warning systems, especially for the developing countries and moving the know-how. Could you really explain a bit more why, WMO is pushing for these early warning systems, and is there any other ways that WMO is ensuring adaptation and preventing maladaptation?
As you said, so we should keep in mind that, of course, the mitigation is should be the highest priority. So without mitigation, we will be in trouble by the end of this century, and even more so by the end of next century. But we should also keep in mind that this negative trend in climate continues for the coming decades anyhow. And that means growing amount of disasters, growing amount of impacts of climate change, and actually the sea level rise continues until next century anyhow. So that's why there's also need to adapt to climate change, and there are various ways to adapt, and I have been member of so-called Global Adaptation Commission, which was led by Ban Ki-moon, the former Secretary General of UN, and we wrote the report, and we are also very much promoting investments for adaptation. And one of the most powerful ways to adapt to climate change is to invest in early warning services. So in developed countries, we can prevent human casualties fairly well, but in less developed countries, that's not the case. When high impact weather event like a tropical storm hits a less developed country, usually have human casualties, and there are also big impacts on economy. The houses are destroyed. There's destruction of infrastructures, bad impacts on agriculture, and so forth. The less developed countries, they are also very much interested in seeing financing for the adaptation. Financing institutions like World Bank and so forth, they have decided to allocate half of their climate financing for climate adaptation. And once you have better early warning services, and you can also forecast the impact of the weather events, then you can prevent both economic losses and human losses. And WMO is serving very much as a platform to transfer on that know-how from developed member countries to less developed countries. For example, UK is very active there. Finland has been very active there. France is very active. And we are at the moment seeking for financing for improvement of the observing systems in less developed countries, which is backbone of the early warning services. And then we have also this water climate consortium. We plan to have better management of the water resources, and again, how to cope with the drought or flooding problems, which are, of course, they're also part of the early warning portfolio.
World Bank is, for example, financing. Is it enough, or do we need private sector as well to finance?
So we need many financing institutions. We created Green Climate Fund as part of the Paris Agreement, and that has been one of the instruments. And now the Biden administration from USA has decided to start financing that institution once again. And European Commission is the biggest development financing institution. I had a meeting with Commissioner Urpilainen a couple of weeks ago, and she said that they have decided to allocate 30% of their development financing for climate-related activities. IMF has such a goal, but we need also private sector financing, and we need also financing from the government themselves. And we have some private sector foundations like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who is one of the main donors. We expect that the founder of Amazon, Mr. Bezos, his foundation is also planning to allocate more resources. And of course, we need also from development banks financing for those purposes. So it's a multi-source question. And the basic thinking is that 50% of the climate financing should go to adaptation and 50% for mitigation. And that's very much the plea of less developed countries.
I think now is this is a good way to go to talk about the water consortium you mentioned before, as you mentioned that they're really working on bringing the private sector in. And it's a great take to talk about it as well, as today of recording is the 22nd of March, which is the World Water Day. You were forming a consortium with other UN organizations to focus on SDG 6, clean water and sanitation, and it's to be launched this summer 2021. Can you shed more light on this project? Earlier you said water, because that's where many of the impacts are felt, and you are really trying to bring in the private and finance sector. What was the motivation to bring in the private and finance sector, and how is the project going?
Yeah, so first of all, the impacts of climate change, they're very much felt through water. They are not so much felt through temperature, which is we are talking about 1.5, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, and so forth. The temperature is one of the indicators of climate change, but the biggest impacts of climate change so far and also in the future, they may be felt through water. We have been getting more severe drought problems in many parts of the world. That's very much a challenge for whole Africa. It's very much a challenge for western part of North America. It's a major challenge in Australia, but it has also affected the high northern latitudes. So we have seen record-breaking forest fires in Russia, in Canada, Sweden, of course, in California, Colorado, Australia, and that's an indication of drought combined with heat waves. And then we have flooding problems. We have had plenty of flooding problems in Asia. We have now more humidity in the atmosphere. When it rains, it typically rains more, and it's causing more flooding problems than before. And at the moment, for example, Australia is suffering because of that, whereas the previous years they have suffered very much because of drought. So of course, this variability is also one of the things. And one component of this problem is the fact that we have seen a boost in the melting of the glaciers. And the glaciers are a source of fresh water for many main rivers worldwide. They are the ones that are giving fresh water resources for North America, the melting of glaciers in Rocky Mountains is a source of fresh water in large parts of the United States. And then the same is true for the Andean region. For example, Peru is a very dry country, and if you don't get this melting water to the rivers, cities like Lima will be really in trouble. That's the only source of fresh water for them. And in Asia, perhaps the situation is the worst. We have the melting of Himalayan glaciers and the big rivers in Asia, in China, India, Vietnam, Bangladesh, they have their origins from the Himalayan glaciers, and this, there has been a boost in the glacier melting, and that means that we are getting less and less water for agriculture, for human beings, and for industry. And in Europe, for example, big rivers, they are also one mean of transportation, and we have already been in trouble at the River Rhine, for example, because of less melting water to the rivers. So this is the problem, and that's why we have built the UN-wide consortium. We have 10 UN agencies who are behind this, and we are just seeking for financing institutions to join, and we have got positive indications from private sector and also from donor countries that they are interested in supporting this. So through that initiative, we plan to mitigate the impacts of climate change in a better fashion. And actually, we have also one related problem which we cannot solve as WMO, but that's population growth. For example, in Africa and some parts of Southern Asia, this problem is boosted by population growth. And in Africa, we already have major challenges in provision of employment, healthcare, and education services for the growing population. And because of the expected impacts of climate change, the situation when it comes to employment, to agriculture is getting worse. And if we triple or even more the amount of population there, that we will have much more victims of climate change. And also in the long run, we may have also more consumers who may cause some emissions. So besides climate mitigation, it's very important to pay attention to the growth of population and birth control.
Yes, many megatrends definitely going on that feed into each other and multiply the risk of each other. And also this has been noted in the WMO's 2030 strategy that you're leading the drastic reformation of WMO to enable the better response to the changing world. How are you ensuring that the change is impactful in the correct way and happens quickly enough so that there is time to respond to these megatrends?
So of course we are just one player, but we have been also able to enhance our portfolio for development financing. Actually, we have largest amount of external financing for supporting of our member countries, and we have major initiatives like climate risk and early warning services, which is financed by 8 donor countries, including Finland, which is our home country, and then we have quite extensive financing from European Commission for improvement of climate services, which are, for example, provision of seasonal predictions for agriculture and adaptation to El Niño La Niña variability, and we have also other means to do so, and we have a new program for improvement of the observing systems, and we already discussed this water climate consortium for giving a boost for the implementation of Sustainable Development Goal 6.
This is really, again, as you say, science and data-based, these goals that then enable you to respond to these trends. And what are the key barriers that you're trying to break between the institutions and effective data sharing?
So backbone of our whole work is free exchange of real-time data. That's the basis of weather forecasting, and that's the basis of also this hydrological services and climate services that we are dealing with, and we have been setting up a standardized ground-based observing system worldwide. We have coordinated the satellite programs of Europe, USA, China, Japan, Russia, who are providing satellite instruments for observation, and then we have also airline companies which are carrying out on board instruments that are important for both weather forecasting and also for the climate science. And our backbone of our work is this kind of free exchange of data, and also free real-time exchange of data. You need real-time data for these services. And we are just working to get more data floating by investing more in the observing systems in less developed countries, and we are also enhancing the willingness of countries to deliver more data for global use, and nowadays we have also some of the private sector sources of such data.
I remember seeing these maps of the global warming and then being these white boxes in Africa especially, and then in the Antarctica. Are you trying to fill these gaps, or is it more getting more granular data for the areas where there is already some of?
So as I said, we have major data gaps in Africa, in Caribbean and Pacific Islands, and some parts of Latin America. At Antarctica, we have plenty of stations, and we have this Antarctic Treaty, and also as part of that, the countries are supposed to deliver their data for free. But of course, and then 2/3 of the planet, they're covered with oceans, and that's one of our challenges, to improve the ocean-based weather observing system.
Definitely a lot of aims and goals to achieve there and different areas. And I wanted to now move on to more your personal work. Is it you published a book called Ilmaston muutos ilmatieteilijän silmin, in English, Climate Change Through the Eyes of an Atmosphere Scientist, where you really focus on the big picture as WMO is focusing as, and you point out that the energy sector and fossil fuels is really where most of the emissions are come from. And there is the science and technology largely existing to replace fossil fuels. What do you think are the main obstacles for pushing this systematic change?
Yeah, so in this book, I was first of all demonstrating what's happening, what's the background of climate science. So what we know about the climate change so far and how the future scenarios look like. And then I was also touching this emission challenge, how to be most successful in mitigation. And one should keep in mind that about 85% of the global changes that we have caused in the real atmosphere, it's based on use of fossil energy. So that's consumption of oil, gas, and coal. And we have seen some sort of plateau in the consumption of coal, and countries like European countries or United States, they're reducing their consumption of coal. But at the same time, we have seen an increase in the consumption of natural gas and oil. And we should convert our energy systems to be based on renewable energy, hydropower and nuclear energy. And we should convert our transport system to be based on electric transportation, biofuels. Hydrogen is a potential fuel also for the future, and there are also technologies to create synthetic fuels from the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and then in the housing sector, we are also heating and cooling our houses. One could use heat pump technologies to reduce the use of energy and some part of these emissions are coming from use of steel and cement, and we could replace some of the construction with the wood materials. Then the land use is also one of the challenges. It's a much smaller component as compared to the use of these fossil energy, which is really the backbone of mitigation. And in the land use, the main challenge is that at the moment we use about 75% of the farmland for feeding the cattle, and that's not very smart, and that's why we should reduce the consumption of especially red meat, and by reducing the amount of meat that we eat, we could be part of the solution. But that's not again the biggest challenge. The biggest challenge is to convert our energy sector, our transport sector, industry sector, and housing sector to become fossil free. Those are the areas where we will either solve this problem or not solve it. And of course, these fossil fuels, they have been cheap and they have been easy to use, and many economies are based on use of fossil fuels. But at the moment, the good news is that these sources of renewable energy, they are most profitable ones: wind energy, solar energy, and of course hydropower. Classically, they're very profitable, and it's attractive for the investors to invest in such fields. And what the conversion that we see in automobile industry at the moment, that's very encouraging. Tesla has been a success story, and for example, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford have now aims to become a part of the solution. So we have a growing amount of opportunities also coming from that kind of sector, and also in the industry sector, For example, in Finland and Sweden, they are developing carbon-free production ways of steam. So, and private sector is moving. Also, the finance sector is moving. So we have very, very good elements to be successful in climate mitigation. But so far, we haven't seen the change in the real atmosphere.
There is a lot of things moving to the right direction. There is promise. We just need to scale it up fast. And I wanted to ask more on this book. What was your motivation to write it?
It was actually the publisher who has been pressing me for a long time. And because of this COVID, my missions to all of the regions, which I'm sometimes spending half of my time on missions, I suddenly had more time to do something else. And then they were again pushing me to publish a book about the facts behind climate change. And that's why I did it. So that's, it was not so much motivated by myself, but it was a pressure from the publisher.
I'm glad the publisher pushed it.
And perhaps my own motivation was that we should also understand the magnitudes of various factors. So there has been sometimes a little bit the bias in the media that they talk about, is it very dangerous to own a dog, or should which cheese is more climate friendly, and also in Finland this forest sink is a major issue. Also in Finland, the key issue is to get rid of the fossil fuels, and that's I wanted to describe what is the magnitude of various factors, and we are very much blaming the aviation to be the biggest problem of that we are having. It's causing at the moment 2% of the emissions. So it's not the major. It's a part of the problem, but it's again the biggest transport sector problems are related to ground transportation, especially cars.
And if I remember correctly, over half of the transport emissions are from road transport.
Even more, yeah.
Even more. So definitely, I can recommend for everyone, World in Data is a, I would say, great website. And if any of our listeners want to go and look into which portions of the emissions are coming from each sector. And our time is soon coming in. I had a few questions to conclude. First of all, could you give any advice to our listeners who want to be future leaders on the international work for mitigation and adaptation?
So of course there are a wide range of specialty areas where it's needed to be part of this solution. And for example, two of my sons, they have been studying engineering at Helsinki University of Technology and nowadays called Aalto University. I have been quite fascinated about the solutions that the engineering sector has been able to provide. So for sure we need such expertise. And this is also a human psychology related challenge. We need also mental change, and this mental change is happening at the moment. And especially you young people, you may be the good teachers for my generation how to behave. But then of course we need also these diplomatic skills. And the fact that we have Paris Agreement at the moment is very much based on the diplomatic skills of French diplomats and the United Nations diplomats. So this was a joint venture of Ban Ki-moon and his staff and the government of France. So also we need clever people who can negotiate that thing. So it's very wide range of expertise. And of course we, as atmospheric scientists, we have been providing the facts on the table. The first IPCC report was published already in 1988, and we have continued bringing those facts on the table, and that's what my current organization is doing as well.
So you can really be a leader at any sector, and we really need a leader in all the sectors.
And this is also a great opportunity for businesses. So I'm confident that this change will happen, and some of the old timers, they may suffer but this is really opening new doors for new innovations and new businesses. And basically, I see this conversion of the world from to become less dependent on fossil sources to new ones. That's really a great opportunity, also economically.
Yes, definitely huge opportunities for all countries. I have to move on now to our last questions. What is the key message you want to send to all our listeners following our discussion today?
So we have a major problem called climate change, and that's the biggest problem for the welfare of mankind this century. And if we fail with the climate mitigation, it will be a problem for the coming thousands of years for the mankind. So this is a problem that doesn't go away if we are not able to solve it during the coming decades. And the facts are very clear. If you don't believe in climate science, then you are not an honest person. So the facts are very clear, and we have been able to demonstrate how the atmosphere works and what we have been able to measure so far. So so the problem is really evident. And to be successful in climate mitigation, one has to concentrate on the key sectors. We have to convert our energy sector to become non-dependent on fossil sources. We have to have a new means of transportation, and then we have to convert some sectors of industry to become carbon free. And then as consumers, we have also power to play. So what kind of cars we are using, how we are heating and cooling our houses. And as consumers, we are buying lots of goods, and sometimes these goods are produced in China with coal-fired energy. And that's one of the ways to have an impact. And of course, this diet. I'm not saying that everybody should become vegan, but we could reduce the use of red meat a bit, and that could be part of the solution. But again, with the diet, we cannot only solve this problem. We have to stick to the fossil problem. And then I would like to say that there's more hope than ever. I have been following this since early 80s when I started studying meteorology, and we have been producing IPCC reports for decades already. But now the message has been heard and understood. And the good news is that the governments have understood the problem, and also growing amount of private sector players have been interested in being part of the solution, and they have also heard the message. And finally, the finance sector is also moving in the right direction. And the promises that the countries have given recently, that's a source of optimism for me. But we still have to give a boost, and we have to see action starting now and the coming 10 to 20 years. If we just wait and see what happens by 2050 or 2060, we are too late. So there's more hope, and I'm confident we can solve the problem, but action is urgently needed.
Thank you very much, Petteri, for coming on to our podcast. And it's been really a pleasure to have you here today. Thank you.
Vice versa. It was a pleasure to talk to you.